G'day folks, welcome to Hang On To Your Hat. You're here with Derek and me and Jeff Barry from Chojo Feature Trees.
You're a naughty boy.
These days, fatherhood is everywhere. You can't get away from it. Not that blokes haven't tried. If you're not a father, you've got a father. You're a son of a dad or a daughter of a bloke. But either way, being a dad is no picnic. The fear, the anger, the confusion and, well, the love, of course. Derek Myers and Dan Lee, together with their special guests, are here to share the highs and lows, the joys and the agony of being a modern dad. But most of all, to let you know that you're not alone.
G'day, folks.
Holy hell. Sorry for cutting you off there, Dan, but yeah, you know, technology comes first.
Yeah, and you also love it, don't you? You love to push your buttons to cut me off.
Well, it's power.
Got any more buttons?
It's power. I like having the power over someone. The kids give me no power.
Exactly.
The wife gives me no power.
This is your domain.
Dan, yeah. When I've got those knobs.
<That's> Derek's knobs.
That's right.
Hello, Jeff.
Hello, Dan. Hello, Derek. Thanks for having me here. Yeah.
Jeff is I refer to him as the bonsai man. Mm-hmm. I'm a bonsai fancier and kind of self-taught bonsai kind of enthusiast, except for the sessions. I've done a few with you, Jeff, and spent quite a bit of time up at your nursery. Mm-hmm. Is it a nursery or is it
a nursery. Yeah, we grow plants there, but we show trees as well. So there's sort of two sides to it. There's a gallery and a nursery.
Yeah, it's a gallery and an exhibit as well. It's the most beautiful bonsai trees you'll see in this country anyway, I think.
Thank you.
And it's in Sassafras.
In the Dandenong Ranges. Yep, right up the top. I think it's about 500 metres above sea level.
Yeah.
A bit cooler than here in Collingwood. Yeah.
That's a beautiful spot.
Is that chosen?
It is good for the trees, certainly through Australians' summer. It's kind of as close as we can get to the Northern Hemisphere seasons.
Yeah.
Because most of the plants that we work on come from that area. Yeah. So it's nearly seasonal. It's not Canadian seasonal, but we have a little bit of a break through the summer.
Yeah.
And just the general environment up there is good for growing plants. And it has been for, I guess, close to 200 years. The gardening up there is very popular as well. So we can grow azaleas and deciduous trees really well. Yeah.
And there's a lot of old gardens, isn't there?
There's lots of old gardens.
European plants.
There is, and there's that culture up there as well. So people really, they have land, first off, so they can have opportunities to do things like that. So that's one of the reasons we're up there. Also, it's a nice lifestyle to
My first girlfriend was in Sassafras.
You're kidding?
Yeah. So we.
What was her name?
What was her name? What's her number?
The only reason I ask is it sounds like
I'm 52, Jeff.
It sounds like a pop song, you know, like if your girlfriend was from Sassafras. I thought if her name was Sally or something, you know,
Sassy Sally from Sassafras.
It sounds like something that Mark Holden would have sung in 1978,
or someone that would want to be released in Life of Brian.
Yes.
Release Sally from Sassafras.
Sally.
It is an interesting culture. You know it, and I know you know it because you nearly grew up there. But when we first moved, because I had another location prior to moving there, we kind of got to know the area, and it's somewhat novel and touristy, as you would say.
Yeah.
Very white, you know.
Yep.
So, I guess some of the dudes you know we work with, they're pretty loose.
Yeah.
So we were working our way to fitting into the little village as well.
Yeah.
And we were coming up with some great sort of, I guess, catch lines, but one of them was put the ass back in Sassafras. Jojo feature trees. Yeah.
Because it was back in the day in the 80s when my parents would take me up there to my girlfriend's house and.
Yeah.
Her parents, which was a harrowing experience. When people live up there, the way they drive around those corners is horrifying.
Yes.
Especially in the day, you could do 100 in a straight and not worry about speed cameras.
Well, there's that horrifying. Right next to all the day trippers who are doing 15 kilometres an hour.
And the cyclists.
Absolutely.
There was no cyclists back then and now.
Put it all together and it is a dangerous recipe for
to fuck storm.
Fucking imagine riding a bike around there. Like
You wonder how they're enjoying themselves.
Holy shit, they're very aggressive. Have you noticed bike riders are getting more and more? Because they're having to defend themselves because they've got a better than average chance
I'm up
of
for that,
dying.
Though. I really am. I'm with them. I love an aggressive bicycle rider.
I sit somewhere in the middle. I love the guy riding his bike.
Yeah.
Mind in his own business. Give him a ton of space. Appreciate it. But you send a pack of those guys up there, and then they get that
That's
attitude.
Different. They're cunts.
And I don't realize why. Like, they know the situation.
Yeah.
So 30 bikes, and as we discussed earlier, some people are less patient than others. So I'm mostly concerned about their
They're welfare. In danger.
Oh, I mean, I don't ride bikes because it's less – well, it's partly because I don't want to die, but it's also because I know how angry and aggressive it would make me. You're on the defensive all the time. Anyone comes in, fuck you! Who came away from me?
Because
people
it's like that.
Because people
like
kick that. Their doors open, don't they?
Yeah.
And just – you think – and they put that bike lane, at least in town, right next – on the inside. It's crazy. I just –
There's two good examples, which is pretty humorous, up the mountain. One, well, from one side of it, someone did a driving act that a cyclist didn't appreciate.
Right.
And somehow caught up to the driver, and she was pulled over, and he managed to give her a bit of lip, reach through the window, pull the keys out of the car, and throw them off the cliff.
Oh,
sort of
my
thing.
God.
Because the cops got involved and all that was in the local paper. I'm like, that's pretty good. But there's also been a few drivers that have knocked guys off of bikes, then grabbed their bike and threw it over this.
Yeah.
So, you know, it goes either way.
I saw a
fair, I guess.
Fair's fair.
I saw a cyclist get so angry in Balaclava. I mean, it's Balaclava for you, but he got cut off or something, and he got so angry, he got off his bike and he threw it through the windscreen of the car.
That's golden. I know.
It was like,
I fantasize. Wow. About when I'm riding a push bike,
that's like
which is kind of rare.
Yeah,
but I do in my head. I fantasize about that.
Okay,
that's why you can't do it.
These guys just risk my life because of some weird notion he's got about rights to the road.
That's right.
And I'm trying my best to stay alive.
And laws and rights—they're not going to save your life, right? So a common sense would be a lot better. And I think that's what I mean.
Yeah.
And I do admire people riding their bikes up there because I know they're doing good for the environment, they're doing good for themselves, and we should have a lot of patience for them. I think there could be some common sense in how you do it in regards to the clubs and that sort of thing. So it's just simple common sense. It's a tiny road.
I respect their – and this is something getting to dads eventually. There's all these sort of overweight middle-aged men in Lycra.
Up there.
And sort of hobbling around in those fucking shoes. Like, the last thing I'm going to do, unless I'm an Olympic cyclist, is get in that gear with all the – do you reckon, though, you know how they have what are they called? Like sponsors. Advertisers, sponsors on them, right? Yeah. Are those sponsors choosing to be on these?
I think they're paying the other way around, I think,
That's right.
It's life insurance or something, stuff like that.
And the other thing is – It seems, and I'm not involved in it, so somewhat presumptuous, but there seems to be this, an element of, I don't know what happened, because when we grew up, or when I grew up in Canada, riding a bike was just, you got on something and you rode a mode of transportation, but there seems to be this, it's like skiing here. You have to be very wealthy to ride a bike, and the gear you buy has to kind of. And I think
I can imagine you're exposed to that, especially on the mountain.
Oh my God, the bikes are worth more than my vehicle.
That's where they go, though. That's a hobby, and the hobby is collecting gear as well as using it.
Yeah. One of our staff at Chojo, he's a strong cyclist, and he does it a lot, many times a week. But when he rides his bike to work, he lives up there, he'll wear like tight jeans and sometimes a leather jacket, but he'll get on his bike and pass these guys in Lycra. So just visually, it looks hilarious. And he's doing it intentionally. You know what I mean?
Like, he's a bit younger probably.
Yeah,
he's getting
up to your age.
It's got
to
be a market. There's got to be a market for rock look bike gear.
Totally.
So that you can actually have the freedom of movement.
Yeah. And Canada was skiing and denim.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it's the worst choice because it takes on the water. Freezes, but it's a great look.
So I first met you when I went up to the to your nursery because I fell in love with bonsai quite a while ago but had no real – you know how it's – I think I talked to you about how for most bonsai lunatics, it just happens – whether you like it or not. Just something happens and you just get mm-hmm. really obsessed with it.
Mm-hmm.
And I went up there, and the first thing I noticed about you guys, apart from that the trees were very worked, very beautiful, and very the art of it was very much there. It wasn't churning them out. Was that young guys with tattoos and mm-hmm. who play in bands and like piercings and just interesting young people working there mm-hmm. by and large. And that's not something that is usually equated with bonsai. Like, I mean, it's more so now the mm-hmm. kind of, but it was sort of the domain of elderly Japanese men or whatever, you know.
I agree. Because I've been involved so long, I have had a bit of a case study in what is the demographic that likes this, and it's pretty broad. But I've said before, because bonsai, the biggest part of it is not the horticultural element of growing a plant. It's really the design. Yeah. So people who are interested in art and design, graphic art, graffiti artists, yeah. even musicians, people that like that process of putting a design into play.
Yeah.
So I think that some of the staff and other artists that work with me, I've always said that. Like, usually they're involved in an element of design or art prior to getting yeah. involved into bonsai, which is, if you understand the art form, is perfectly normal.
Yes, it makes total sense.
It does.
Well, apart from anything, you're much younger and you've got time to see the bonsai.
Well, there is a practical element to that as well. But in Japan, there was a story last year how they were concerned how the art form is dying off. And that's purely because in Japan, they see it as exactly what you say. It's an old person's hobby or something. And I think that globalization has made that difference. Because if you go to Japan and you see what the young people are interested in, it's in like punk rock music, you know, or something like that, that you wouldn't necessarily attach to the Japanese culture as you would something like bonsai. And but the good side, which they didn't really approach in the story, is globally it's growing astronomically.
Oh, really? Yeah.
In fact, Australia would be one of the probably younger countries in the bonsai world getting involved in it. So through North America and Europe, it's really big, proper industries and whatnot. Mm. But even in South America and in Eastern Europe and whatnot, it's really quite a large, there's a large following and people practicing it, yeah.
And so I was, the reason I wanted to, well, apart from because I love to nerd out about bonsai, which I don't want to do too much because this is a fatherhood podcast, but on the occasions when I've brought trees to you and we've sat them on the table and we've looked at them and gone, all right, where does this want to be in 10 years or 20 years mm-hmm. and it's that sort of imagining into the, it's like slow sculpture because you're letting the plant do the sculpting itself. Right. So you kind of, and you've got to let it go in, you're kind of guiding it, not fighting with it, mm-hmm. blah, blah, blah. Now, what I found happened between you and I when we did this is we might spend an afternoon working on a tree, wiring it, doing stuff. We ended up talking about life generally and the parallels between the guiding of this tree and the ideas of going with and humility and surrender to, as well as your desires and interests and ambition for it, blah, 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 all this stuff. Because you're never totally in control of it the way you are with another art form like sculpture.
That's right. Your medium is alive.
Your medium is alive. Yeah. And you could, and there's always that exciting, terrifying risk that it could just die like that.
There's that as well. Yeah.
And so then I just thought, well, surely bonsai is like raising children.
Bonsai is like everything, really, I found, because at the end of every statement, as you said, it's kind of like bonsai, really. You know, you can. But it by all means, it is.
Oh, God, I was terrified that you'd say this.
Yeah.
Because I admit it, I've had a bonsai.
How many have you killed?
Yeah.
How many bonsai have you killed?
Only the one. It was like it cost me a lot of money mm-hmm. and it was 30 years old.
Yeah.
And I killed it.
And how do you feel about bonsai after that?
When you say it relates to, that's it. Yeah. When you say it relates to parenthood, I go, what the fuck? What sort of problem am I going to have?
Bonsai is very hard and it's very easy to make basic mistakes.
Well, I wasn't bonsaiing. I just bought
the
thing.
Yeah.
It's a whole different world.
Yes,
and it I can see that. You can see there's being a bonsai artist and there's being a person who owns a bonsai.
Yeah.
It's clearly
You
can design cars or you can just buy a Ferrari.
Mm-hmm. I think it sort of mystifies people.
Yeah, yeah.
If they step back for a minute and thought about, I don't know, fourth grade science and put that into play, you'd be all right. But because of films and misconceptions about the art form, people go, well, this is, I know it's a plant, I know it's alive, but somehow, logically, they want to put it beside their bed. And then you would say, well, let's go back to fourth grade science. What does a plant need?
Yeah.
So it's. I find the element of keeping a bonsai alive really quite simple. And probably your kids could do it, you know. People have problems with it, but it's not challenging. Art is challenging, and you never stop learning, and the aspect of training your eye and design and those sorts of things. But keeping a plant alive, we should be able to do that. And I think it's a big statement about society.
I think it'd be a great prep for parenthood. I know that it's more shocking for people like me who can't keep a bonsai alive. But look, I could have, but I went away for a little while and died, right?
And the thing is about it is they don't give a shit about your schedule, right? Neither do your kids.
No, exactly.
You know, and so to say, well, you know, we just had that holiday for 3 weeks in January and I thought it would be all right, you know? I guess that's one of those statements that where you're like, well, like this, let's keep going. It's a living thing. How would you go without water for three weeks in 40-degree heat, you know? So again, there's nothing.
You've just got to be conscious of it all the time, right?
Of course.
Don't you?
And it's like parenting.
Like parenting. So a lot of people are used to having a pot plant in their house that are certain species that can survive fucking anything. And they've got
You mean a pot plant?
Yeah, yeah, yes. Not a smokable plant.
Somehow people don't forget to water those ones.
Yeah. But they also, ones aren't as sensitive.
Complex watering techniques.
The bonsai are in a small small pot usually.
They are.
And they're more prone to
drying out
and things like that.
Sure.
So,
but that's back to common sense, right? Mm. So there's an amount of volume in the pot and the exposure to the elements are going to dry it out at a certain speed. So you should know it's going to dry out. It's going to take this long. It's going to need more water.
Yeah.
So a bigger pot just means maybe a little bit less frequent, but what I'm saying is a bonsai is really just a plant in a pot. In fact, that's the direct translation of it. Bonsai, you know, it's plant and pot.
It's not nearly as mystical as it sounds.
Yeah, I know.
So does this mean if we're already drawing parallels between children rearing and raising bonsai, and you've got to kind of recognize their natural tendencies and features and support those, but also nurture them and encourage them this way. Does that mean it follows that we should wire our children's limbs and hold them in place when they're not
big? Because even as you speak those words, and I think how parallel, what are the parallels? And because my bonsai teachers, especially the good ones, really encourage me to work with the tree.
Yeah.
And there's a moment where control gets involved, right? And you are an artist and there's you and there's the tree and you're trying to make art. You can take a couple approaches to it and say, I want to make whatever I want to make out of that. Or you can sort of contemplate the qualities within the tree and try to help that make your decisions. And now we have to start thinking that way. So we can't, and we don't want to dictate the destiny of our children. That's something that we want them to do. But of course, we want to help them make the best decisions for themselves along the way. And perhaps there's the parallel, if you have to see what your child just naturally inside likes and then encourage them to make the most of that. And that's probably the closest parallel. Well,
yeah, and Steve Biddulph said the other week when we saw him that you don't, and it's probably a well used phrase, but you don't make your children, you meet them.
You have to.
And I think it's something that the education system is slowly coming around to, that sort of nurturing the natural direction that children are going in.
Yeah.
And that to me is a very large parallel with when I was sitting with you looking at those trees, and I might have a vision of what I want. And all parents have this with their kids, you know. You think your kid's going to be a certain way, but until you actually start observing who they are, because they're totally who they are, then you're not going to know how to best nurture them. And I might have an idea for this bonsai. I want it to be really heroically doing this.
Yeah.
But until I look at the reality of what it's capable of mm-hmm. and what nature and growth patterns and the species and all that stuff determine, then I can't make an appropriate kind of path of encouragement, let's say.
Sure.
And that, so that's, I think, yeah, I think that's
agree.
A parallel.
I agree.
Yeah.
I think inside, maybe, in my experience, my, you know, if you have kids that people compliment, lots of times they want to throw the compliment at the parent, right? And in my case, my daughter is just like a really lovely little person, and it's not because of me. You know,
yeah. How old's your daughter?
She's 9.
Yeah.
And as she grows, this personality keeps blossoming, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure being in a good environment and growing in a good environment and being loved helps those things. But inside all these kids, there is this real personality. And I think that's probably, I kind of want to say 50-50, but I don't think that. I think it's more who they are. As who they become, and all you can be there is to sort of guide them in those sorts of. And the older my daughter gets, I only have the one daughter. I got all my stock in her.
Yeah.
I see. I think that's more valid. And as she, so, yeah. And I think that parallels with bonsai. I think if you really think about what's the best way to get the best result, it's always the answer is going to be is sort of try to find. That thing within the child or that thing within the tree to really enhance, you know? So I'm certainly at that level now. I think I'm learning as much, it sounds cliche, but I'm learning as much how to be a good person from my child than telling her how to be one, you know?
Oh, that comes up here a lot with us talking about that, if you're willing to grow and become, this is the opportunity of a lifetime.
Absolutely.
Because kids are going to,
I'm sure you must have touched on this a lot because it's pretty it's pretty wild when you think of all the hang-ups. Like, kids are so honest, right? So, we struggle to even communicate sometimes because of just the bullshit in our lives. Like, and when you want a real honest answer, ask a 9-year-old, you know? they'll tell you. And you're like, wow, man, you are good at communicating, you know? And so that's where the learning comes from.
A 9-year-old girl, especially.
Oh, man.
This is where the gender.
She'll let you know what's what. Yeah. And it's not, and it's it like, even if the news isn't good, there's no sense of telling you to make you feel bad, but she doesn't know how to lie.
There's no baggage in it.
Yeah, there's no baggage at all. Yeah.
It's interesting. So as we get older, communication becomes increasingly more about, or language becomes more and more about avoiding communication as well. Like you say a lot of stuff to avoid what you really mean.
Or buy time to think about.
Or to buy time or whatever, or for diplomacy or whatever. Yeah. And kids don't have that.
No.
And this is, I just want to come to playwriting for a minute, because as you know, I've talked to you about my playwriting.
Yes.
The part of making characters and theatre interesting is not having them say exactly what they mean, because we don't do that. We do all these things to kind of dance around the issue and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And getting, kids just don't do that.
No,
I think I talked to you about this play that I'm writing at the moment, that I've been writing for bloody years, that I told you about, which has the bonsai in the central.
Yeah, of course.
It's got a big bonsai tree in the middle of the room. And I've used this.
Hang on, a big bonsai tree?
Yeah, I know. That's, whoa. Yeah.
Exactly.
<That's> relative.
We might. Oh, yeah, I hadn't thought of it like that.
Yeah.
There are some very big bonsai trees.
Yeah.
It's even at yours. I went to town with the metaphor of the bonsai and the sacrificial branch.
You may need to explain that, because a lot of people may not know what that means.
So the bonsai is present in the room with these characters all the way along, and it becomes, it's like Chekhov's gun. I'll explain that later. If Chekhov said, if there's a gun on the wall in the first act, then you better use it in the third act. Otherwise, people are going to be going, why is that there? It's got to be of some use. So if this bonsai is in the show, it's got to perform some role at some point. So he's debating all the way through the play whether to cut off this branch, but he doesn't know why it's there. And often you grow a branch very low down on the trunk of a bonsai tree, and you let it grow sort of unchecked.
To use resources?
Well, no, it broadens the trunk to make the tree look older and broader.
Okay.
And then the idea is that once the trunk has been broadened enough, you, to correct me if I'm wrong, you chop that off, and it's called a sacrificial branch. It heals over, but you're left with a huge trunk.
Is it an emotional day when you the day you cut that branch off?
Well, this is the amazing thing.
Is it a big ceremony?
Or well, yeah, I think there is a decision-making time. So essentially, you explained it well, but the tree is triggered to increase the size of its trunk because it feels it needs to hold this sacrifice branch in the position. And the lower it is, as you said, the thicker it is. And in bonsai, we really like nice natural taper, right? So anything like a telephone pole isn't a very good bonsai. So about thick at the bottom, gradually getting thinner to the top.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that helps you in that process. So you kind of are going, the one thing that is interesting about it is you're going, well, this branch is growing very, very thick. And this could work in the play as well. You have to decide when is the right time where the scar won't be too large that will sort of affect the overall aesthetic of the tree because you want it to heal.
Right, right.
But you want to get the most out of this branch. So there is this sort of like, ooh, is today the day or do I want it to get bigger?
And the decisions you make in bonsai.
But that scar is going to get bigger.
Yes.
Yeah.
So. And the decisions in bonsai are on geographical time. You know, like you might have had this branch growing for 5 years and your decision when and how to cut it is going to affect the process of the whole tree. So there's a humility in this because the tree has
can't make that decision.
No, and it's also going to perform the way it performs
based on nature
and all that stuff. So in the play,
what happens at the end?
I'm trying to think how much I can say.
No, we'll don't.
So it's to do. No, it doesn't. It's to do with him. It becomes a mechanism later on for him to talk about euthanasia. I'm using the parallel that this branch is having an effect on the trunk. If the trunk is a family,
and a member of the family is said branch,
then at what point is he's weighing up whether to remove himself from the thing?
Deep, man.
And he ends up using the without saying it directly, he ends up saying to another character, "I'm going to leave it up to you to cut the branch when the time comes."
Wow. That is very directly
connected. But never mentioning I want you to do.
Yeah, yeah.
So, that's where the bonsai, it'll be sitting there the whole show driving him crazy.
Remember we talked about how we were going to do it?
That's
because
right.
Because you can't cut it off more than once. So if you blow it, you know, and next night, you know what we're going to do. So we came up with an idea of fake cutting the branch off.
Yeah. Oh. But since then, I don't think we even need to cut it, which is nice.
That would be all right.
That helps.
Yeah. Well, maybe on the final night.
On the last night.
you'll find a magician that runs you through how to easily.
Yeah. I thought of a way, ways we could do a fake cut.
Because I would love to have one of
Why don't you just stick another big bottom branch?
Well, I was thinking most of them, when you grow a sacrifice branch, you usually grow it out the back of the tree because of the scar issue.
Yeah.
To the viewer in the crowd, we could cut a fresh branch off of one of my stock trees, makes no difference. Yeah. And we could place it in the position of this.
Right.
And go clip.
They don't see where it's.
You don't see where it's.
Every night.
Yeah, that's right.
Did you notice he said, so you grow the branch out the back of the tree. Now, people listening might think, well, but how do you make it grow? You can't make a tree grow a branch where you want it to. And no, you can't. You just have to wait and hope.
Yeah,
right?
You have to have faith. Hell.
Oh, it is children.
Wait, hope, faith. It is children. Mm. Like there's certainly and with lots of life, there's a combination of what you can do something about and what you can't do something about, and then the ethics of what you should or shouldn't do anything about. Should you just let a tree go? Should you, you know? But you definitely need to have the. Another parallel is spending time with it. A thing that comes back in these conversations is that time spent with kids, regardless of, you know, quality time as such, is what matters. It's just the more time you just spend with kids, just being with them, the more they know that you like, you know, you like them.
Does
enough
a little
to
tree
spend
know?
Time with
Does
them.
It know?
No, but it's just by spending time with those trees that you notice what they need and see what can happen. Mm-hmm. You can't just kind of rush in and go, am I right?
What about too much time? Can you stuff it? if you
you can keep on you can fuck around with the tree around. To for well, that's like negative results. Yeah, yeah, yeah,
that's helicopter parenting.
Yeah, it's kind of.
So that with the parallels, I've just fascinated when we talk about parallels before.
Yeah.
There's one other, and you would probably, if you're bonsai guys, you must be obviously exposed to people going, "Isn't it mean?" Or
that's the classic
in the world. Yeah, in the world of the parallels,
mm-hmm.
where what is the tray, the little bowl? Is it your shit financial abilities in your 20s and 30s that made the kid had to live in a smaller house? Is it the fact that
you can't just send them to
private school? Is it though? Is that
your rations? Does
the tray represent?
Well, I think
best you can do.
Well, no. So the bonsai pot practically does two things. One, it houses the root ball, where the roots give the tree its water and nutrients and whatnot. It's very important horticulturally. But secondly, it's part of the overall composition. So there's a pot and there's a tree, but together they become a bonsai.
Mm.
So that's the reason for the pot. I remember it is an art form, so the aesthetics are very important in regards to the overall look. So there's no element of torture putting a plant into a shallow pot. It's about the aesthetics of the art. But your previous point, and it does come up a lot, and it kind of baffles me, but you have to understand bonsais are like the most pampered plants on the planet. If they need something, there's some caretaker there looking after them in every sense of the... So if you're putting a... Like, the torture isn't from the pot. It's from the shitty caretaker who doesn't water it when it needs to. So don't blame the... Yeah, that's right. That's right. You have to understand... I think people, they can walk into my shop and say this to me a lot. It's like, why do you torture these plants like this? And I don't, what usually, most sensible people turn around when I say, okay, where do you live? And they say, well, I don't know, Roeville or something. I said, do you have hedges up the front? Yeah. What do you do when they kind of are overgrown? You pull out the hedge cutter and you smash through them with no regard, no tears, no... And yet you come into my shop and you look at my plants and you think I'm doing cruel things to them, you know? I'm saying, where's that line? Like, where?
Mowing the lawn.
Yeah, mowing the lawn. What does the grass think about? I can't stand
mowing the lawn. Yeah, that is a huge organic being there.
does the grass not like being mowed? And I think the same argument, and a lot of people will turn around right there and go, you know, that's a fair point. You know, all we're doing is pruning plants. We water them. We feed them. I think there's a visual element of when we wire them, it kind of looks torturous, but as you know, we're simply manipulating the direction, sometimes radically, sometimes subtly, to the branches and the trunk lines, and we do not want that to get tight on the tree. So I think there's a visual element where people's imagination get on top of
the wire. Is not permanent, is it?
No, of course not. No, it goes on, comes off, occasionally goes on again, comes off.
It's the natural human anthropomorphizing thing that
absolutely.
We do.
And why you can turn people around quickly and even almost make them feel foolish in their own sense.
It's how Walt Disney made his money.
Exactly.
Rip off someone else's line.
So I like to put that there, that we... it's sort of like committing yourself to having, well, we can say a child, but I was going to say a cat. Like, when you take this on board, you're taking on the responsibilities that come with it. It's not putting a tree in the forest and letting the ecosystem take care. It is you. It needs you to look after it. And if you're not willing to do that, then your bonsai will die and it will suffer. But that's not due to any of the techniques that we use in the art.
Do you know what upsets me is going into those, you know, news agents or little shops that have half a dozen bonsais out the front and they've been sitting there for 5 years and the wires, they've grown and the wire is just cut into them because the wire has not been replaced. Because the idea is to just put it lightly kind of around it. It shouldn't, and it should be removed before it starts scarring the tree. And and it's just as it's holding it in a certain position or a place, and that's torturous.
See trees in the suburbs growing around wire fences,
kind of thing. But again, you're assuming it has emotion.
That's back to what I was saying before. Yeah. Like, and it's not being condescending at all. But in Australia, most people, when they think of bonsai, they think of that. like in a hardware store something like that. Whereas, you know, bonsai is a really beautiful art form, and the results of it are amazing. So from my perspective, I'm always blown away how it's kind of like, I always say, let's say you run a shop, a golf shop, and people come through the door and they're pretty much at a level where they go, what is golf? That's right. Where you're starting.
Yeah, you know
what I mean? It's like, take your pencil case out of your bag. Now open the pencil case. So you're really walking them through the process of not only how to do it, like what is it?
But that's what they get a sense of at your place, is what it really is. Because in Australia, we've had, they're just kind of something you give to your dad on Father's Day.
Yeah, and let it die in a month. That's bonsai. Yeah.
But then you go in there and you can, and because a lot of your trees, you sell trees as well, but there's also a lot that are exhibit trees that you don't sell that people can look at, or you have shows or you rent them to people for certain events.
All of those things.
All sorts of different
keep in mind, like we
run classes.
Yeah, we do all those things.
Yeah.
But the trees that when you say we're not selling, like we have a, like we talked about, you don't really start working on a tree till you have a concept of where it's going, a design plan overall.
Yeah.
So sometimes we'd like to see the tree get to said place. So if they're not for sale, it's probably because we're still working our way to that.
Really? But there must be some. There's no way you're going to sell.
Well,
I suppose everyone's got a price, though.
Yeah.
Well, once you have children,
you know,
everything's got a price.
Once you get hungry, you choose to eat, right?
So I don't know.
No, I've already broke. I feel lucky to do this for a living, and I've chosen not to allow those feelings get in the way because I've learned from lots of different teachers, but one in particular, a Japanese apprentice, he really explained to me, you know, once you put your energy and your thoughts into a piece of art, it's always yours. You don't need to own it.
Yeah,
you know, you own that intellectual property, and you own that tree. You will always own if you designed and created it. And for me to own everything I work on isn't something that I'm trying to achieve.
It's an immature artist approach in a way. And you, because the journey, the work that you're working on, it's what's important.
Yeah.
It's hard, but that's a...
It's hard, but it's also, I feel privileged if I sell a tree and I make money and I'm able to look forward to the next project. Mm. And that's the way, I guess maybe it's survival mentality, I refuse to sort of...
Yeah.
Shed a tear about it anymore.
And just as one day you'll have to sell your child, and
you'll have to
let go of her.
It's the parallels again. Just pass it on.
Yeah,
you got it. When the price is right, you got to know when to sell.
Yeah, I've got to be a little bit careful with this bonsai. Like, there's not direct parallels, but just in terms of the mind. But I tell you, hey, listen, with my son, when the time I spend in spring out sitting in the garden just.
Twisting wires around
twisting
him.
Twisting wires around him, saying, stand still while I fucking wire this thing. You're going to grow this way. When I'm working on trees and I'm just pruning and gently sort of picking the buds out and things like that, he calms right down and he'll sit on my lap and just look at the – because I'll sit there for hours in spring just looking at them.
Yeah.
And then it's a lovely thing where he'll sit on my lap and we'll just talk about the tree and we'll look at it. And it's one of the rare times when – we're not racing around. Yeah. And I'm very grateful for it making me stop.
Yeah.
And it also slows him right down.
Mm-hmm.
And then sometimes for the rest of the day, he and I will just float around the backyard and there's no nagging. It somehow resets that. And how's that been with your daughter? Is she?
Well, she's grown up with it. I literally has been in the nursery since she was like an infant.
Yeah.
And she does have, she really loves bonsai. And I just get the feeling because, just like we talked about before, I don't insist on her practicing bonsai or anything like that. But I think there's a sense of osmosis that one thing I say to a lot of students is like, just be observant. Look at nature, look at the way trees grow. And so being around things that are of a high quality and being around parents who work hard to get that quality, I think that's sinking into her. She likes the wire the best at this point in time. So now if I'm wiring, because I wire in my house at night and stuff, so it's really fun if you've never had bonsai wire because it's very pliable and you can shape it into
copper?
We work with two different types. There's copper wire and there's... Oh, I'm so sorry. Copper wire and there is aluminium wire as well.
Yeah.
So, for kids, I mean, it's sharp on the ends. I'm not suggesting people go and have their kids play with wire, but that's what I do with mine. So she enjoys that. She enjoys the aesthetics. My whole family, I think they know what a good bonsai looks like. And that's something that it takes a long time to teach a student how, I think she appreciates, like, I play in a band and I do this as a job, but I think what I'm seeing at this age is, and I think this is great. Like this is, it's sort of, and it doesn't matter if it was bonsai or not, but I like as a parent sort of taking hold of the reins in a sense and saying like, this is what I do for a living. It's not easy. And if it were any of those artistic endeavors that sort of push you to be more yourself, I think your kids take a lot from that, so that's the important bit. Like, so bonsai has just always been in her life. Do I see her starting to thinking about designing trees and doing stuff? Not really, not yet. But I wouldn't expect her to, you know.
No. You're right though. That, like, seeing a parent who's willing to take time on something and is passionate about something and enjoys what they're doing. I mean, that's got to be very valuable.
I think so. Because it creates challenges. Like you guys probably, you know, I know to some degree you're in the arts, but there's always really hard days, like, you know, so it's easy to just say this is too hard and go get a job. There's nothing wrong with going to get a job. Everyone needs to get a job. But I think for whatever we lack in money and nice cars and stuff like that, I think they're gaining lots from I think being true to yourself, you know, and if that's the lesson alone, that's huge.
I'm relying on that being the case.
Yeah.
You know, like I've made that decision to go, right, we're going to be happy
as
much as possible. And I reckon there's a benefit to the kids, not only in your case, you're the master. Like eventually your daughter's going to go, oh, hang on. It's like realizing your mum's Missy Higgins, right, or something like that. Yeah. Like oh, my God.
Yeah, it is funny.
If they worked it out, my dad's not just has an interest that's very unusual, and I can talk about it as show and tell,
right?
But, oh, my God, he's actually the big kahuna Melbourne of bonsai.
Sometimes this comes up, and my daughter's at an age where like, you know, Missy Higgins, for example, your partner, she talks about fame, you know? And I think about that, and I do quickly talk to her about, well, people in my position, it's not at all about fame. It's about the craft that you see me doing all the time. And if you succeed with that, sometimes, not in bonsai, but sometimes there's some small element of fame because people like the work that you do. Yep. But the important bit is the work. Yeah. So don't strive for fame. Strive for that achievement that you're working on your painting or your bonsai or your song or whatever. Well, and I really got to drive that home as the kids get older. It's because this world is just about fame, right? You do things to be famous, not to achieve what you're trying to achieve, which is worth a conversation with the kids. You know,
and bonsai is so slow. And it's so process oriented. Like there's almost like I've had to deal
such a long game.
I've had to deal with that with playwriting. The shock of how you can't finish a play without relying ultimately on a whole bunch of people to produce it. Eventually, it's got to go on, or it's not kind of finished. It's not realized. But it is the actual performance is really a tiny, tiny iceberg tip. With a huge amount underneath. And if you're relying on the outcome or getting famous or everyone loving it, then fuck, you're really going to be disappointed. Yeah. What you have to do is go, I have to love this process and be getting some fulfillment and stuff from that process. Because then if you can fall in love with the process and make it and find the benefits of that, you can always have process. No one can take process from
it. That's right. It's almost like we were talking about before. Yeah. That's yours.
Yeah. That's yours. And so if you're deriving your energy from that, then hey, you're sustainable. But if it's for fame or riches or whatever, then shit, man, it's really gambling on, because you're always waiting for the day when.
Totally.
So you're modeling that at least. You're modeling this is slow.
Yeah.
You better like the doing of it. Because it may, oh, again, I don't want to, you know, it's a horrible thing to say, but the tree could die. When you're dealing with it, when you're dealing with a with a living plant, it could just or it might just not work.
I think there's lots of ways to approach bonsai for sure, and you can look at it in overseas. America has a big bonsai growing very quickly a bonsai community, and their exhibitions seem to fall into a sense of competition.
Yeah,
which is interesting, and at the end of the competition, always. There's a big bag of money, you know, that you're striving towards. So there is this element of bonsai, like you can judge it or grade it to some degree. And that's one end of the spectrum. And then there's a famous bonsai master again in from Osaka. And he didn't speak English, but I was watching this interview with him. And he just said the most, like, in regards to that concept, it really hit home, but he said, virtually translated, he said, the person who enjoys their little trees the most has won.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Right? So, and that, of course that's true. So it's back to what you're saying. It's really the journey. Remember, nothing is forever.
No, that's right.
Even if trees can live for hundreds of years and everyone's amazed by that, that's the irony. They will not live forever.
No.
Right? So a painting you can put into a museum and protect it and do all these things. Mm. But people are blown away how long they can live for, yet it's art that will eventually not be there.
Yeah.
So you're sort of like, there's a sense of, it's like a paradox because you're blown away that they can last for hundreds of years and it is art and it takes all this work, but you know it will not be there, you know, at some point in time. And I think that is that's a life lesson, really, isn't it?
Yeah, that's part of a story. Like, if you're around taking care of this thing from when it's 120 years old,
that's right,
through to when it's 175 years old, you're doing that thing that all the megalomaniac leaders do, put statues up. That all, everything we do is somehow putting a statue up.
That's right.
You know, our place in time is all there is, and we do it by having kids, maybe not deliberately, right? But we have kids, and then all we can do is make them the best. And it takes us a little while to realize is not to make them into the best things, to help them become the best, to make them be their best, right?
That's right?
And to grow that way.
And be as true to the nature.
But it's this long game thing. Do you think... before we wind up, do you think that being a deep long game guy, your what obviously started as a hobby and then became your whole life, is clearly about considering the long game? And as you both just said, the process of that is the game, and I believe that too. In my morbid, you know, my morbid positivity of going, the kids have to enjoy this year and not sacrifice this year for a better life in the future or anything like that, because they might not be there. You know what I mean? Like, everything you give them is dependent on how they live up until the time that they're not around anymore. But that long game, do you think it really made you just launch into parenting well? Like, do you reckon it made you a better dad?
I think so.
Yeah.
I think that question that we're talking about now is bigger than bonsai and bigger than parenting. It's about life, isn't it?
Yeah.
We don't know how long we're going to enjoy something, so you should enjoy it now.
Yeah, yeah.
But in regards to bonsai, I do think so, because as everyone would throw immediately patience. There's one thing about patience in my job is people see having a bonsai like you have to wait a lot for it to do what it's going to do. But as Dan knows, I have hundreds of bonsais. So, so in my world, patience doesn't really come up. They're waiting for me, right? So I have so much work. So the trees are always waiting for me. But one thing that it's that persistence, you know, is about staying focused, you know, and I did this prior to having a child. So I think that really helps my life, being able to say, like, you know, just for that moment, when you have hundreds of trees and you're trying to care for a nursery and run a business and do all that, you have to find that moment of focusing on the one tree for this moment. you know, and, yeah. and be able to block the rest out. And maybe I think that that helps in parenting, you know, like you like, cause life's just crazy, right? You know, and yeah. you got this precious, the most precious thing you have right in front of you. You have to find a way to, when you're decision making, to really have focus on this moment, on this
be
person,
to that.
And be entirely yeah. present yeah. for that. And
what's in it for them?
In my yeah. job, I think that's more. It's not the patience thing. It's that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. yeah.
Being able to really see and hear.
Absolutely.
And yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And be. Yeah.
It's something that came rocking into my head as a new as a something to ask you.
Yeah.
In the first minute of us talking, and yeah. I can't believe I can still remember it. This is a miracle. Yeah. This is an absolute miracle. Is it, it? And it's something I'm touching on in the next few weeks. Immigrants.
Hmm.
Immigrants.
Yes, I am.
Right. So you're obviously from Canada.
Yes.
What about your partner? Do you have a partner?
Yeah, my partner. She's Australian. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, we moved over here from Canada.
Yeah. So yeah. You've got half rooted right. in Australia. Okay. So. If you're a bonsai obsessive or master, or I can't say master because that's an official term, a black belt,
yeah, okay.
right, in Canada,
mm-hmm.
is that how does that work? How do you bring your
whole plants?
How do you bring your career if they've 100-year life of a plant?
Well,
and you're halfway through.
I've been here a long time, so,
okay.
so my collection's been
that's
based
true. Did you have any over there?
Well, I did, but like,
so you started again?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And in it's nothing to do with bonsai. It has to do more with Australian quarantine. That's not even
yeah.
an option.
Yeah,
and
that's
if
what
you,
I was
if you were
you
to move from
it.
Country to country, depending on where you're from, and where you're going, more importantly, you could with a lot of. Move your trees. So the industry over in North America and Europe is heavily based on imports.
Okay.
So in Australia, that's one of the things that we cannot do, which is interesting because obviously bonsai industry in China and Japan is quite big. So if someone decides they want to open a bonsai nursery in England, they can just dial into Japan and order a bunch of trees over and yes. bam, put them on pedestals and they're an expert.
So other countries
right?
don't have the same quarantine as we have?
Oh, no. Oh, Australia okay. is quite
you
unique.
Crazy. I never knew
about that.
Quite unique. You can't bring anything with roots or any potting medium into the yeah. country. And I mean, a lot of bonsai artists.
I know even with vehicle tires.
Oh, yeah.
They have to
yeah,
be
it's
washed.
It's quite
scraped.
Tight. But they seem to throw bonsai in the same category as like agriculture.
Yeah.
Where, I don't know, I there would be higher quality trees in Australia if you could import, but I don't necessarily, even in the industry, I don't necessarily, I think I like the process. So just buying a finished tree or close to finished tree from somewhere and bringing it in, I don't even crave to do that. Yeah. So it's more of a hunt. It's finding the right stock to work on and doing it that
so
way.
So with that, so further that the immigrant thing.
Yeah.
There, my question has been answered. Like, are these trees anchoring you here even more than an Aussie wife?
Oh,
and, you know, like,
yeah.
like stopping you from making a decision to
I'm really
to flip
flawed
back to
about
Canada?
That. I don't think so. Like I said, it's the craft that I do. I already kind of, although I kind of really feel passionate about the projects I'm working on, it's not the ownership of the trees, you know? So it's really, you know, teach a man to fish kind of idea. I can make bonsai anywhere because I've been taught and trained how to do that. And I could probably, to some degree, make a living anywhere. So would I miss the trees that I worked on? I think I, like I said before, I think I still feel like I own them, even if I wasn't here. You know, I mean, I created that tree. It's
like a painter.
Someone who can afford it owns it now.
Yeah.
I can't really afford to own them. Mm. So does that bother me?
Mm.
No, not really. No.
When just before we go, I wanted to just tell you about when I was in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
I went to one of those famous bonsai places and you see it in books and in fact, there was a tree there that I looked at and I went, oh, I know that. It was like a rock star. I went,
wow.
I know that tree.
Yeah.
Oh, it's a very famous tree. It's been just come back from tour and
it
was like a 500-year-old tree and I've seen it on the covers of books
and
fucking things. I got all fanboy about it. I got all embarrassed. But it's this incredible garden in Tokyo and ancient trees, like, God. And we were wandering around and there was a sort of no one there. And then this little guy popped out from a row of trees, a young French guy mm-hmm. who was an apprentice, and he was probably 22 or something. Hello, can I help you? Please come here. And he was like, he was sort of a bit huddled. He looked like someone had been swinging at his head a lot. So he was kind of... And I got an insight into what it's like to be an apprentice in the Japanese bonsai system.
Yeah.
And he had gone there and he was like second year or something, and he was still...
Sweeping the floor.
Sweeping the floor and making coffee and being abused, basically. That he said, they just make jokes about my accent all the time. All they do is...
It's no wonder.
This is rubbish. All
yeah, well, that's, that's normal, though, isn't it?
Yeah, and then maybe by 6 years I will be able to work on a tree.
Yeah.
And he's like, please, come with me. I will show you around. And he was like a cave fish.
Yeah.
And he got... And then we had to go, and he's going, oh, you don't have to leave.
I'll show you more trees.
Did he slip you a note?
Yeah.
don't say anything out loud. But and he showed us around all the trees and all the stuff. And he was clearly, he had a bit of, what's that called when you're in love with your captor? Stockholm Syndrome. Because he loved it. It was beautiful, but he was still also enslaved. And some of the trees were like, this is the $1 million bonsai. And the bonsai master bought this property with a pot. He sold one of his pots and bought the land. So it was some ancient pot. And just seeing stuff on that scale and holy shit. Most trees in Australia have been started here.
Yeah.
So you're not going to get that lineage of. So there's this handing down, speaking of fatherhood. And I assume it's mainly father to son, if they want to.
In the Japanese culture, typically.
But some of them were definitely handed from.
I think there's, say, 5 or 6 generations now. Bonsais have been working. Through a family. Yeah, so that would be the most. And remember, you're kind of familiar with the concept of Yamadori. So lots of times before bonsais even started, they collect it from the mountains, right? So the tree itself could be 300 years old before the bonsai process started. And then 6 generations of a family work on it.
Mm.
So that's how you get to these incredible, 500, 600, 700-year-old trees, right?
Yeah.
And
then there's trees that have witnessed things. Like there's a tree in America that was given to them by the Japanese. It survived the Hiroshima bombing. Blah, blah, blah.
Some get names. Like the most famous bonsai in America was created by John Naka, who's a very famous bonsai artist. And it was sort of like a gift. And it represented his 11 grandchildren, 11 trees as a forest.
Right.
And it's, once they get to some level of fame, they get named. So the tree itself is called Goshen. And it's definitely America's most famous bonsai. Yeah. So,
does it go on tour?
It probably does to some degree. Yeah.
Oh, that would be harrowing.
I reckon.
Transport.
Don't draw much.
It's bad enough with children.
But.
I think it's a lovely and it certainly helped me with my relationship with my son, just slowing me down because I'm a bit frantic.
It's nice.
It's been so.
I think maybe having children will help me become a better bonsai artist.
Turn that around.
I think it's the other way around. I couldn't have imagined back when I was in my 20s, every morning having to make lunches at the same time, point my finger at where's your shoes, and do all this just as part of the, just this.
Well, to turn it around, as you say, your bonsai's making you slow you down a little bit. Well, I think to say it's only when I started like going in and reading to my daughter where it sort of feels like a pain in the ass on the way in.
Yeah.
And then now it's kind of evolved to where we both read, right? And she just likes me to hang out on when she goes to bed, and I'm sort of like, oh, I could be doing this and that.
Yeah.
But it's usually, within that first 10 minutes, you realize, this is probably the best moment of my day. Because you made yourself stop, or she made me stop.
Right,
And sit in silence, run my eyes over some words that are inspiring, And then when I could easily, like, she's probably nodded off. And sometimes I find myself just sitting there, you know, because, like, you know, that's...
Enjoying the moment.
Yeah, enjoying the moment, you know.
So it's a frame of mind change. It's so true. Kids are an invitation to learn. They're also an invitation to be present and in the moment because they're operating at a different pace.
That's right.
See, I've had that too. We've both, Derek and I, have talked about that, that you can go in frustrated that you've got to slow down. It's
that guilt that you...
Yeah.
You just got this guilt. Oh, 5 minutes ago, I can't believe I was going.
Yeah, what a dick.
For God's sake,
I'm
no
such
reading
a dick.
Tonight.
Yeah,
just go to sleep.
Yeah, I have, for you what? Know, I want to, whatever, do some accounting. You know, such
and
bullshit,
there are times,
really.
There are times when you are busy, but there are a lot when you're not so busy that 5 minutes or 10 minutes
that's
is,
right.
You know what I mean?
I don't think it's officially meditating, but it's certainly playing that role in our modern day people where you're like, you're recharging your batteries. You're taking a moment to go, okay, well, you know. And back to parenthood, like, you know, that's where we're always gaining, you know. That's one of those honest things that gets thrown in our face. Like, you're going, all your shit isn't as important as you think it is, you know. You see people rushing around in their BMWs thinking that getting to this appointment is so important for the world to keep turning, and it's just one of those great reminders that you know, our shit is nowhere near as important as we think it is, you know.
Cue becomes a moment's respite instead of the nuisance if there's nothing you can do about it.
Yeah.
And I, you know, and same with the kids, it's if you can let it be, then that'll happen.
That's right.
I took Luna's really crook. She's been crook for 3 months. She's got impetigo, I think. It's like a staph infection on her face and stuff. So she looks a bit like a zombie with that. But I took
her
around.
You should consider letting her in the house, as we said earlier.
Children in the house? What are you talking about?
I let my kids stay indoors, just in the laundry, when they're sick.
When they're sick.
And it just, helps.
So I took her out in the garden, even though it's so cold, because she loves being outside, as all bloody kids do. It's funny, isn't it? They want to be on TV and screens, but it seems to me that you get them out there and put them in a pile of dirt, and they just, especially little ones, maybe that's how she got foot and mouth disease. I don't know. But, so I took her out, and she... And I took her around the bonsais, or around all my trees, and she touched them all and felt all the different. There's a black pine that's really prickly that I got from you, and she touched it and went like that. And then she went around and touched the sort of ficus leaves that were all soft, and we went around and she touched all the different things, and I'm watching her face as she felt certain textures for the first time, and I was conscious that
the different cracking sounds you get from different
when you break branches. None of my kids, I think Sammy might have
don't say it yet, mate.
I've tried to expose them to them.
They're still footballs.
Well, I thought as long as I don't tell them, don't go near them, because otherwise then they'll want to go near them. I've tried to mix them together, but just watching her feel and touch these plants and the texture of them, and knowing that. This thing that I take for granted, this is the first time she's come into contact with this kind of sensation of the plant and of the thing. And you can somehow project yourself into their head and see it through their eyes. And that's one of those moments, a beautiful moment of watching them have this original experience
that's
that
true.
You could just
it's true.
Brush over.
And I mean, when they interviewed me for this magazine, that was something that, you know, we were touching on, is that anything that's bringing these kids, our kids, closer to the natural world, and bonsai could be one of those things, is really benefiting them, because the world is rushing them away from it, right? And that's coming back to about people don't know how to look after a tree, don't know how to grow a plant. Like, we've lost all, and the reality is we're part of the natural world, regardless of how many devices we have. If we can get our kids, however, if it's bonsai or through permaculture or gardening or just being out in the forests, being out in nature,
picking mushrooms,
it's actually picking mushrooms right time of year. I think that's probably one of the really large benefits, I think, from doing something like this. We have to push them and remind them they're not above this world we live in. They're part of it.
And the human brain has only had 180,000 years to evolve to where it is, or it's had that much time, and now the increase of technology. We just don't have the bandwidth.
No,
these right. things are a way to alleviate some of that traffic in the
head.
How
good are we? I see, because I used to make furniture and stuff like that, and I see the industry going more and more ready. You know, IKEA, Freedom, whatever, you know, it's, everything's just mass produced. It's like everyone's getting hammered. It's off, all offshore and everything like that.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, in parallel, this obsession with mid-century this and restored this and handcrafted. So we balance it, and maybe that's part of that surgence or resurgence or whatever.
I think so.
Of proper young ferals and stuff getting into
like bonsai. Slow food, like,
it's just like, give me that long game.
Mm-hmm.
Give me something that doesn't isn't designed to trigger my reward senses every 7 seconds. That's right.
I think we're catching on. Desperate. I think a society is saying, like, we're fooled by this bullshit. And there are some people who say, you know, I'm not going to take the bait of my iPhone. I'm going to grow my own food. I'm going to live a happy life the years that I get to live and not, you know, race with technology. Mm. And I think you're right. And there probably always will be the other end of the spectrum, right? The harder it pushes, the harder the other side will push back, you know?
And it could be also our natural desire for that balance.
Yeah.
Like all day, every day, have Spotify randomly paying everyone 0.0007 of a cent, rah, 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 yet go to the record shop and come home with this round record, and just trying to balance it off.
Yeah, that's right.
Everything's so fast.
There's no doubt for me.
This kind of thing is going to absolutely go gangbusters.
Mm.
With my this
analog stuff.
Profound growing mental illness that I'm always struggling with. I'm being a bit dramatic there. But
yeah, I wouldn't say growing.
But I have no doubt that sitting there face to face with a tree in the garden for hours, I mean, you just got to find the thing that does it for you. If that doesn't do it for you, then it doesn't do it for you. But I'm fucking holding on to it because I can sit there and fall into this fantasy of looking at this tree. And it's like when I got the little ceramic fella from your nursery, and Sammy can put the little figurines around the trees, and you imagine it's a big tree with these little people sitting around it. So if you can let yourself go into this little fantasy, this meditative state where you imagine the tree and the things going on, then you're doing the meditation that's required to empty it out. Because I think for a lot of frantic-minded people like me, sometimes meditation is difficult because you're suddenly opening this space up into which all this self-analysis and chatter actually goes in. And with training, you can get better at that, but it's a hell of a confronting thing, silence, sometimes. But when you've got an activity like pruning a tree very slowly or just observing it, you're not entirely alone with your thoughts. So it's a type of meditation without the horror of just an echo chamber of your head, you know? It's focused meditation.
And you don't need, and there's also skepticism as well. Like, you get people that meditate the shit out of stuff, but who would go, meditate, get fucked. What are you talking about? Get fucked. Yeah. I'm not a fucking hippie. But they're meditating the crap out of life.
Yeah. Yeah.
But through these things.
This is back to reading with your kid. That's the way I feel.
Yeah,
I don't meditate, like, you know, properly, but I think I'm gaining while I do that exactly what someone who was a master at meditating, because you can feel that sort of grounding, if you will.
Exactly, coming into yourself and the situation and the place and down from your head into your space. I mean, man, that's so hard to do and increasingly hard to do.
Well, because we're constantly fighting against it, you know. I think our society is so there's no time for grounding. Why would you ground, you know?
Yeah.
You could tweet. You know, so
and then you have a moment where you're standing in a damp forest, like up at the in the Dandenongs or something, and you suddenly have that, like when you have the realization when you're reading to your child, you're standing there beneath a tree, and you make the switch, and you go, oh my god, what have I been doing the last week?
Why was I 5 minutes ago worried about
worried
looking
about
at iTunes, whatever it is? Just to wind it up,
sure,
your band, let's have it.
Okay.
You just let it slip. What's going on here?
I did. I play in a band called Lost Canoe.
Oh, Lost Canoe?
Yeah.
Or Lost, like Lost Lobos? Lost.
Lost.
Yeah. Lost Canoe.
Yes.
It sounds, there's something about canoes in Canada.
Yeah. I don't know if that came in. We're a 5-piece band, and I can plug a couple shows.
Let's go.
I got July 20th at Zooks in Belgrave. And then
is Zooks the new
Gin Lane? It's the new Gin Lane, but we're playing at Sookie's.
Oh, Sookie's, that's what
I'm going to guess a bit here. August 22nd as well. There's some more.
What's the style?
We're like a psych band, psychedelic band. Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Ooh. Yeah, I'm coming.
You're coming.
Can I come?
Oh, you're coming.
Yeah. I'm going crazy for the psych stuff at the moment.
Yeah.
We should all
just heard another one at the Community Cup. It was a dude's name. It was so good.
Yeah.
It was so good. A bit like sort of Mild Life, but a bit more.
Yeah.
Even it's more psychedelic, less jazz. It was awesome.
We just got our
first road trip.
Yeah, absolutely. You should come out. Especially that Sookie's one will be good. Zooks is great. It's really small, but it's great.
You've got a record?
Great energy in there.
You got a record?
No, recording now.
Gonna put a vinyl out?
Yeah, we definitely.
Will you come and be on my Aussie vinyl show?
Absolutely.
Yo, beauty. Absolutely. Entrapment. That's what it is.
We got Chuck the CW Stone King support a couple months ago.
Oh, wow. There.
So that was our first big. First,
how good you are.
Yeah, well.
That's awesome.
Well, we were lucky too. The bar owner liked us. So that's where we got that. Yeah.
Yeah, but fitting in with that.
Yeah.
I love CW. I've seen him a few times.
Great. Yeah. Well, I'm a Tom Waits fan, so.
Yeah.
He's in a bit of a lineage with Tom Waits.
Truly is a brilliant Australian artist, and especially because I've been listening to him for a while and that, but playing with him, and I've seen him a couple of times, but it's extraordinary.
He's got a lot of kids. We should get him on here.
You should. He's got a very interesting vocal delivery, even in speaking to him.
Oh, really? Well. Oh, yeah. Goodness. I haven't actually met him.
I've had a few chats. In fact, I bought a record off him.
Did
in
you?
The street out of the back of his little funny little car one day. It's like, hey, Dubs, hey, W, or whatever I called him. He got a record in that car. He goes, oh, yeah. and he talks the same way.
He does. He talks like he sings. Yeah. He's really quite he's a lovely character too.
Excellent.
He used to be involved with my friend Simon Nugent. Played together and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Anyway, well, I look forward to that. And thanks a billion for coming in.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
All this way from Sassafras, which is a sister city of Mississippi.
That's right. With all those S's. But thank you for having me. It's great to meet you, Derek, and good to see you, Derek.
And obviously, I could do the in-depth bonsai discussion for hours and hours.
Yeah, we don't want to
bore. No, this is the fine line. Trying to make an interesting
bonsai podcast.
Nerdfest.
I get in trouble. Missy, I sort of... with great embarrassment, sit there watching YouTube videos of people pruning bonsais. Mm-hmm. Like hours of this. All you can hear is the scissors snipping.
Yeah.
And Missy comes in and goes, what the fuck are you doing? Some old guy from... And I'm like, that's great.
The beauty in this?
So now I have to watch it in secret like it's pornography or something. It's
one of those weird videos of people just making... little funny noises.
Yeah. Or rustling laundry or whatever.
Yeah. And will you come back?
Oh, I'd come back. Updates? Yeah, absolutely.
I've got a 9-year-old daughter as well. So be
as you to see and I didn't confirm 9-year-old and what else? That's
and I've
it.
I've got an 11-year-old boy.
Okay. Yeah. So you're well on your way.
I mean it.
Yeah.
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 Well, yeah. Thanks again. That was great.
It was a pleasure to be here.
Lovely to chat. See you, folks.
See ya. That awesome podcast was recorded at Castaway Studios in Collingwood. Here, we provide affordable, accessible, professional podcasting production facilities to the full range of podcasters, all the way from basic studio hire right through to full season production packages. You can get us on castawaycollingwood@gmail.com or just look up Castaway Studios on all the social medias. Hey.